is consider taking these 10-dimensional string theories we've been working with and compactifying, which is, after all, what a lot of people have been telling you that ultimately we'll do. So let's put the strings on the simplest thing we can think of, which is a circle. So let's study closed strings for now. So there is the mode expansion that I gave you previously. And are those lights normally on? Do they make the screen? Is that fine? It's fine? OK. It's not fine for me, but oh well. So I can't actually see what's on. So somewhere there should be a mode expansion for the closed strings. And I'm not going to say much about the oscillator parts. That'll just come along for the ride. So if you haven't done this before, work this through. It's very easy to do. And you'll see what comes of it. So as we said before, there's a momentum. I have an alpha 0 and an alpha 0 tilde 0 mode. And the momentum is just the thing we had before. And in fact, we can recover what we first wrote in our string mode expansions previously in the following way. So remember that everything is periodic as we go around the string. And I think the lights have gotten dimmer, so thanks. Or it's my eyes. OK, thanks. And so as we go around the string, everything should be periodic. So let's just ask that that be true for this mode expansion. And so we'll see, how does x change? It changes as follows. And so it shouldn't change because everything's periodic. So this had better be 0. And so in fact, that just recovers what we had at the very beginning about the relationship between p and alpha, where we just wrote a single alpha instead of an alpha tilde in the 0 mode sector. OK, but I'd like to, for full generality, keep alpha 0 and alpha 0 tilde separate objects for a while, as you'll see now. So now let's ask that one of the directions is actually on a circle. So there's a circle of radius r. And so now, in space-time, I have the fact that the let's pick the x9 direction. And it's just saying that I'm on a one-dimensional lattice with period 2 pi r. So when we go around the string in this way, there's the relation we had previously. This part no longer need vanish. In fact, it could be any multiple of 2 pi r and still be a good solution to this condition of being on a circle. So that gives us a new condition. It says that this is some multiple of 2 pi r. And let me call that multiple w for winding, because that simply means that as I go around the string once, it goes w times around the circle, if you think about it. And so that's a new sector we've introduced into the theory called the winding sector. The momentum in the circle, it's a circle, it's a compact direction, and so momentum is quantized, and our units are such that P9, the ninth direction's momentum, is just n over r, and that is indeed the thing that we should equate to the general formula for our momentum previously. So in this direction, in this compact direction, we have these two equations. We have two equations. We have two things we'd like to find out what they are, alpha 0 and alpha 0 tilde. And we can solve them. And so a little bit of playing around will give you a solution which looks like this. So that's the solution for alpha 0, and that's the solution for alpha 0 tilde. So that's rather nice. We have a result. We know what alpha and what alpha 0 and alpha 0 tilde are in terms of the parameters of our problem. And so we can simply go ahead and compute the spectrum of the string now with this inserted for the ninth direction. So this is a straightforward exercise. You just write down L0 and L0 bar as before. And remember that your mass squared formula in the non-compact directions, the directions not including the circle, is still coming from p mu, p mu. And so this is essentially L0. That's essentially L0 bar. I put in alpha a left and a right, depending upon what sector you're in. It'd be either minus a half or 0, as before. And this carries on as before. And all of this n is just that formula involving the counting of the number of alpha excitations and psi excitations as before. So I can take sums and differences of this formula, and that gives me this for the mass squared formula. And as we discussed before, there's an additional condition coming from L0 minus L0 bar, which is what's called a level matching formula. You can do more interesting things to do level matching. You can combine momentum and winding to offset whether n is equal to n bar in when you're on a circle. And that's the mass formula. So let's study this mass formula. And let's observe a number of interesting things about it. So in particular, so there it is. In particular, let's first check that we've got everything right. Let's first check that if we send r to infinity, we unwrap the circle, we send the circle back to being just a line, that we get what we expect. So that should be a decompactification limit, if you like. And so indeed, we see that we have the usual oscillator stuff there, and then we have these interesting pieces here. There's a ladder of states, the momentum states, which are spaced, which have spacing 1 over r, and there's a ladder of states, which are the winding states, which have spacing omega times r, sorry, not omega, w. And as r goes to infinity, you can see that this ladder of momentum states, the spacing becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. And so what's happening is that that discrete spectrum is getting closer and closer to the situation that it should, which is that it recovers a continuum of momenta. The spacing becomes infinitesimally small, while the winding states, all winding states become heavier and heavier. They become infinitely massive in the limit and leave the theory. And so we end up with what we should have, which is the decompactified theory with a continuum momentum in that compact once compact direction, which has now gone non-compact. So that makes perfect sense. So now let's take the other limit, which is to check to see what happens. So now explore new physics. Let's see what happens if we shrink the circle away and send r to zero. So I don't know what to call that, so I've not put anything in the box like I did before. The momentum states now become massive, in fact, because r is going to zero. And so the momentum states leave the theory. And that is, of course, what you would expect if you were a field theorist. It says that the degrees of freedom associated with momenta in the internal directions become more and more massive as the internal directions shrink away, and eventually you, you dimensionally reduce your theory. That's what dimensional reduction is when you think about it. So indeed, this looks like what should happen if we are constructing a nine-dimensional theory by starting with a 10-dimensional theory. However, we have to try and understand what happens to these guys. What happens to these guys? Well, the winding states are becoming the light states here, and in fact, the spacing between them is now dropping to zero, and so we're recovering a continuum of momentum in that direction. So at this point, we could be really puzzled, or we could just call it what it is. If we see a continuum, if we see a continuum arising, we might want to think of it as momenta again in some direction that is decompactifying. And so the spectrum looks awfully like we're recovering an uncompactified theory again, even though we would have, as field theorists, not anticipated that. So we should call this a decompactification direction as well, just as we did in the previous case. And so that leads us to realize that strings have interesting new properties that you don't have in field theory because of this winding, this ability of, that they have to wind. And so this is the origin of T-duality. So there's our mass formula again. And the point is that if I define a new direction, a new radius, r primed, which is alpha primed over r, I see that if I exchange momentum and winding states, if I relabel everything as momentum, that's momentum as winding and vice versa, and I exchange what I call a large circle and a small circle, r primed and r, then the theory doesn't care. And so that's T2RT. The physics is the same, so there's a large and a small circle, and the physics of these two things, as far as the string cares, is the same. And so that's T-duality. And a huge amount of what is done in modern string theory and in much of what we're going to talk about is organized and inspired and fueled by this T-duality property. So what I want to do is think about T-duality in several different ways. And an extremely useful way of thinking about it is to go back to that formula we wrote for we derived for alpha and alpha tilde and observe what happens if I exchange n and w and r and 1 over r, or alpha prime over r, in this formula. And you see what happens is that it simply, so there we combine those things. And what we find is that it simply tells us that whereas alpha 0 remains the same, alpha 0 tilde picks up a minus sign. So on the world sheet, it's just a simple parity transformation that in space-time we interpret as exchanging large and small circles. So that's rather nice. And you can naturally discuss the physics in terms of the string theory that has circle of radius r primed in terms of this dual coordinate, which I'll call x9 primed, which instead of being x9 plus x9 bar, or x9 of z plus x9 of z bar, because of that minus sign, I have now this dual coordinate. And if I write all my physics in terms of this, then I'm writing the physics of the string on the dual circle. And the important thing to note is that the string theory, the entire conformal field theory, all of that formalism we built up, just doesn't really care much about that sign. So this is a really important lesson that we, if you look, for example, at the energy momentum tensor, which was all important, it just doesn't care about that parity very much. So this is a very important lesson about how string theory views space-time. Certain things that we think of from field theory intuition is extremely important, which is that I'm doing string theory, I'm doing physics on this particular circle with this particular radius. The string doesn't really care about that so much. It's happy to do the same physics on a different circle with the inverse radius. And there's several things like that which are called duality, as you may know, in string theory. And so this is an important lesson. There is one important thing to note from what we were doing with the supersymmetric string theories. Notice that world sheet supersymmetry implies that this minus sign corresponds to putting a minus sign on in the ninth direction, so psi 9. And if you track that through when we constructed the type 2 strings and everything, if you track that through, that corresponds to S4 being minus S4. So it means that things we were counting that had S4 in them, that had eigenvalues plus halves, have minus halves the other way around, minus to plus to minus. And that means that what we were calling one chirality of spinner in space-time, which we were focusing on for the GSO projection, becomes the opposite chirality on one side. So if you track that through, that means that what we're calling the type 2A string theory exchanges with the type 2B string theory, or vice versa, when we T-dualize. So the story is the type 2A string theory on a circle of radius r is another closed string theory on a circle of radius alpha primed over r, and it's just the type 2B string theory. Okay? And so nothing could be simpler. Well, I guess the bosonic string, because it's the same theory. But anyway. So there you go. Any questions about that? OK, so that's T-duality in essence. And there it is. So you may wonder, what about open strings? Well, for open strings, this ought not to work, right? There are a couple of things that were really important to make this thing work. And we don't have them in open strings. So for example, we don't have winding. It's not a good conserved quantity anymore. If you wind a string on a circle. There's a circle. If you wind an open string some number of times on a circle, it'll just unwind. So not good. Can't really swap that with something like momentum, which is a good conserved quantity. So what we might expect then is that if we shrink the circle away, we won't have this winding contribution, and so the theory should then be genuinely a nine-dimensional theory because we don't have the winding sectors rebuilding this continuum for us. So that should be a lot more like field theory. But on the other hand, if I were to do this, stand in front here so you can't see what I'm doing, and I did that, and asked you to tell me which one was an open string and a closed string, hopefully the class would split into 50% versus 50%, because you can't tell until I take my arm away, because the only real difference is the endpoints. So somehow, away from the endpoints, the argument I just made might not be quite easy to make, because somehow locally it just thinks it's part of a closed string, and so it should know about the 10 dimensions. It should know that no amount of compactifying away circles should make it 9-dimensional. So we have a little bit of a problem here. How do we square this circle? And the answer is not to compactify on squares. Which would be interesting. Okay, so, but here, before we proceed, maybe one way of getting around this is to say, if we could sort of invent some means by which we stick a tent peg or something to trap the ends of the string, maybe we could kind of get rid of the first objection. If we could nail in something to keep the ends fixed, so we would have then some sort of something like conserved winding. Well, having observed those that story, let's just follow our nose. Let's just be experimentalists for a while, see what we can do. So I can write the open string mode expansion just as I did before. This is somewhat artificial because there's only one set of oscillators. The left and right are not really independent, but we can still write it in that way, in the sense that I have x of z and z bar, z and z bar, as the sum of two pieces. So I write them this way. I've introduced this thing I've called x primed here, and you shouldn't worry about it, because when I add these two things together to get me the full open string expansion that you know and love from before, that'll just cancel out. So I've just, for fun, added it in. And then I took it away. So that's okay. There you go. My slides agree with me. So let's now place one of those directions on a circle and explore. So let's explore the dual coordinates. So let's write everything. Let's make it the ninth direction. Let's write everything now. Instead of x9 of z plus x9 of z bar, let's write in terms of the difference, and that's the dual coordinate. So that should be telling me about the physics of the dual direction, whatever that is. Okay, so let's just follow our noses. So if I just expand, it looks like this. I'm not really writing the oscillator bits because nothing exciting happens there. And I just use the exponential map to get back to sigma from z and z bar, and I get this. Well, that's kind of interesting. Notice that there's no tau dependence here. So there's no center of mass momentum, which is interesting. In that coordinate, x primed actually survives, which is interesting. So we need to figure out what that means. So let me ask a question. Where are the endpoints of the string? So the endpoints of the string are in the dual coordinate are at x prime 9 when sigma is set equal to pi, x prime 9 when sigma is equal to 0. Those are the two endpoints. So let me just see what their difference is, how far apart they are. And what I find is that it's 2 pi alpha prime over r n from the formula before. The 2 pi came from inserting value of sigma. But if I wrote that in terms of the natural quantity, which is not r but alpha primed over r, which is r prime, then I get 2 pi n r primed. But if you recall, the x9, the dual direction, is periodic with period r prime. So in particular, the string endpoints are in the same place, which is kind of interesting. So that certainly isn't what we started with. The free string endpoints were free to do whatever they want, and now we find in the 9 direction, they actually must be in the same place. Well, of course, that's the Dirichlet boundary condition that I promised you we would discuss when we looked at the basic solution of the string equations of motion. So the ends are not free, they are required to be at a particular place. Well, it makes sense to actually draw a picture of this, and that's the picture. Okay, and so this depicts what we just found. There's a 10-dimensional space-time. This is the 9 direction. The string endpoints are free to move wherever they please in the directions that are not the 9th direction, so that's anywhere in this hyperplane. And then they must be frozen to live in the 9 direction. They can only be at position x prime 9. And so that defines a hypersurface, which is called the D-brane. In particular, it has 8 spatial directions, and so it's called the D8 brain. I'll say more about that notation later on. So are there any questions about that? Okay, so notice that I think I noticed it later on. I have 2 sectors of string here, the case n equals 1 and the case n equals 0. In fact, what I had is what I claimed. We found naturally that the string theory told us how to introduce this way of trapping the ends. It's also told us that, yes, some of the physics, but only that of the endpoints, is 9-dimensional, the part that lives on this hyperplane. And the interior of the string still thinks it's a 10-dimensional string. So we've managed to achieve everything we set out, and we found a new kind of winding. A string can start and end on a brane, or it can start on the brane, wind once around the circle, and then end on the brane. So that would be the case n equals 1 in that previous formula. Okay, so that's rather nice. What else did I want to say? Yes, so we have something like winding as promised. Okay, so you might ask, what of Chan pattern factors? How does that come in? All we've done so far is just the case of the open string with a U1, a simple U1 associated with it. Well, let's do the oriented case first, where we have UN. What I can do is I can start in my full 10-dimensional string theory, and I can place the theory on a circle. And I can, just for fun, I can pick a particular background for the gauge field. So let me ask that the particular background I choose, I have a particular abelian Wilson line here, so UN breaks to U1 to the N, and all I've done is I've chosen that in the 9th direction, I have this choice, which if you think about it, is in fact just pure gauge. I can write it like that for some matrix that you can deduce the form for lambda. Well, that's kind of interesting because it's not quite pure gauge because I have a circle. So as I go around the circle, as I go around the X9 circle, you'll see that everything will transform with a phase that looks like this. You can deduce this by realizing that, of course, the string endpoints look like charges of these U1s, of charge Q, and they would couple like this, and so that would give an action, which you then exponentiate, which you would call W, the Wilson line. And so that is, in fact, the phase. As X transforms, you'll see that it picks up a phase as I promised. That looks like this. Okay, so that's rather nice. Whoops, that wasn't supposed to happen. Okay, so pretend this comes up later. It'll make sense in a moment. The canonical momentum thus gets shifted. I have these things charged under some U1 gauge field, so I should go through and recompute the the canonical momentum, and I find that it's no longer n over r. There's a piece coming from the fact that it's charged. So in the normalizations we've been using, the string endpoints are charged plus or minus 1. Remember, the string is oriented, so it's in the n and n bar of the un. And then when that breaks to the u1s, it's plus or minus 1. And so what I'm going to do is end up with a string in this state, using our notation from before, is going to have momentum that looks like that. So I just now need to go back to my calculation where we discovered the D-brain and say, instead of putting in P9 equals n over r, it's now n over r plus this additional piece over 2 pi r, which just comes from the charges. And my notation is such that the string with n's ij are coupled to the positions theta I and theta j in the matrix in the obvious way. So if you put this into our earlier computation, what we'll find is that the string endpoints now differ in this way. So there was the first term talks about our original string setup with a single brain and winding given by n. But now actually I have a whole bunch of other choices coming from these thetas. And notice basically that this gives us a new t-duality relation, not spelled correctly, which says basically that position is essentially dual to 2 pi alpha primed times the gauge field in that internal direction. So I'll say more about that on the other page in a moment. So this gives us a picture of multiple D-brains, because it says that there are D-brains at all these other positions given by these Wilson lines, by the diagonal components of this of that background, the Wilson line. Okay, so there it is. So I can have brains which stretch, strings that stretch between different brains, or they can stretch between different brains in addition to winding some number of times around the circle, and it's all very complicated if you just wrote it down in terms of boundary conditions, but visually it's very clear what's going on, and that's part of the power of D-brains. They very much organize the calculus of boundary conditions in open string theory in a very geometric way. So as I said, the D-brain's position in the dual coordinate, which is the compact coordinate dual to the original coordinate in which you place the open string theory, that its position in that coordinate is just t-dual to the components of the gauge fields in that direction. Well, I want to talk about this in a little bit more general language now. Bear in mind that what's going on is that I can pick a particular set of boundary conditions, and then that's just some vacuum solution for the string theory. But then what I find is that there's a bunch of massless modes which correspond to the fluctuations, the quanta, the massless quanta about that particular background. And that's what I would call collective dynamics if I were a soliton person. That's the collective dynamics of that particular vacuum choice, that particular D-brain. And so notice, first of all, that if I look at the mass formula, which looks like this now, that I have two particularly interesting sectors. I have the following sectors. I excite massless modes, which correspond to strings with the same ends, with their ends on the same D-brain. And those are the things that I previously just called the components of the U1 gauge field on the brain. And then I have same things, but with the compact coordinate, x9. Direction. And so that is also a component of the gauge field. It's an internal component of the gauge field, so it's A9. I might as well call that a scalar and that a vector from the point of view of the SO1,8 piece of the Lorentz group that lives on the world volume of the brains. So the language that people will use several times is that there's a gauge theory on the brain, on the world volume of a brain. And that simply means that the space-time, the space-time which the brain fills, has a bunch of gauge fields and a bunch of scalars, which transform in the adjoint as well, as I'll say in a moment. And those are just the internal components of the gauge field from the T-dual picture. So people will play with all kinds of weird and wonderful theories, and this is essentially the logic they're using. Okay, so, right. So when I look at several D brains, the story is much the same, except now I have a bunch of, so look at the mass, same mass formula. Now I get mass of states also from strings stretching between brains. And if the brains coincide, if theta 1 is equal to theta 2, I'll have a new set in addition to the modes coming from string stretch between brain 2 and itself and brain 1 and itself. There'll also be strings stretching between those brains. Those will give me, if you think about it, I will get precisely the number of extra massless states required to take the U1 cross U1 associated with two separated brains and turn it into a U2. So think about that for a while. For n brains, I'll get n squared different types of massless string. Okay, so that's the collective dynamic. So from we'll talk a little bit in a while about the properties of brains as solitons, as real dynamical objects in the theory. And whenever someone discusses solitons in field theory or wherever, they like to discuss the collection of massless excitations called the collective modes. And it is interesting that for D brains, and this needn't have been true, but the theory is has told us this, and it's quite a beautiful and remarkable fact that the collective modes of this particular class of solitons are just gauge theories. Okay, so what else do we have here? So we can also construct D-brains of other dimensions. We just keep T-dualizing. So it's easy to see that the Dirichlet and Neumann conditions are T-dual to each other. That's what we just derived. And if I T-dualized in that direction again, I would have just turned my Dirichlet back into Neumann and gone back to what I would have called a nine brain, filling the entire 9+1 dimensions. Or I could T-dualize in another direction. So there's the manifest statement of the T-duality between Neumann and Dirichlet directions. I can express at Neumann and Dirichlet conditions in terms of derivatives tangent or normal to the world sheet of the space-time coordinate in question. And I lifted this from my bosonic string discussion and so forgot to change my 25 to a 9. And so you can see, basically, that in going from the dual to the undual coordinate, I just exchange Neumann with Dirichlet and vice versa. And so in any number of dimensions, the DP brain in D dimensions is defined by simply have, so there are the D dimensions, and I simply have, in my world sheet theory, Dirichlet and Neumann conditions as follows. I have P plus 1 coordinates, which tell me that the string is free, the string endpoints are free to move in those directions, the world volume of the D brain, and then they're fixed in the directions transverse, which are the Dirichlet directions. Okay, so just wanted to make a couple of comments about T-duality and unoriented strings, because that was something else we constructed. And what we found there, if you recall, is that there was a nice thing called omega, which we used to construct strings. Unoriented strings. So for closed strings, recall that's what I call, say, an internal direction. I'm using M for the internal directions as I did on the previous slide. And I would write the dual coordinate in terms of the difference instead of the sum, like that, as we've learned. And omega, what does omega do? Well, omega just exchanges Z and Z bar to get an unoriented string, if you recall. So if I put that together, I just find that just means that the dual coordinate is mapped to minus itself. So when I project the theory, projecting onto things even under omega, what I'm going to do is I'm going to simply ask that this is now a space-time parity, if you notice. And so I will actually end up equating x for all of my internal directions on that circle. I will have that they're equal to minus themselves. I'll draw a picture of that in a moment. But it's easy to say what to do for open strings. For open strings, we should be looking at, for example, SON Wilson lines. Okay, and those look like this. So I have I've grouped things into pairs because that's what happens, and you should play with this yourself to check that that's I'm not making this up. I have for every theta one, for every theta I have a minus theta, like that, right up to n over 2. So now if we put this in our open string story, and we put this in our closed string story, we try and draw a picture of it. What do we get? Well, here's the picture. We get something called an orientifold plane with d-brains sprinkled around it, apparently descending into the mists of the sea or something like that. Something's fading there. That's odd. Okay, not to worry. I think you get the picture. So there I have, at the fixed point of x goes to minus x, I have what's called an orientifold plane, which is to say that that is a fixed point of the omega projection. And so, in fact, all strings that are localized at this plane are unoriented, whereas strings that are related, strings that are away from the orientifold plane are related to their mirror images over there. So you do, omega tells you to relate them to the state of a string at the mirror image coordinate, in addition to doing a parity flip on the world sheet. And then the d-brains are just located symmetrically. I have a d-brain and I have its image in the orientifold, and that's what the Wilson line told me. So that is the story of how to construct unoriented open and closed strings, and the t-duality thereof. Notice, by the way, that what I've done in spacetime is I've constructed an S1 over Z2 orbifold. So if you haven't seen an orbifold before, this is your first example. So it's probably not the best first example because it also has non-oriented string sectors as well. But geometrically, that's what it is. Okay, so this gives us a new view on what the type 1 string theory is that we constructed last time, and that is that it actually turns out to be 16, if you look at the counting I just gave, remembering that we discovered that SO32 was the gauge group, it's 16 D9 brains and what I ought to call an orientifold 9 plane. So they're 9 because they're filling, it's Neumann everywhere, they're filling the entire space-time. And what actually happens, the consistency conditions we were worried about concerning anomalies in the field theory, in the string theory, can be reinterpreted as the following setup. The D9 brains actually carry a certain charge, what I'll call 10-form charge, because it would be a 10-form that I naturally integrate over the world volume of a D9 brain. I'll explain that in a moment. And this actually turns out to be cancelled, satisfying Gauss's law, a Gauss law constraint, asking all the flux lines to begin and end on the charges that source them. It's cancelled using an O9 plane, which actually has 16 units of the opposite charge. So at this point, if you haven't seen any of this story before, you're going, charge? Huh? What's he talking about? So that's what we should discuss next. What are we talking about when I keep talking about these charges? So before I proceed, are there any questions? Because what I've done is in 35 minutes, I've given you essentially a whole t-duality lecture. So that went rather fast. So those of you who haven't seen this before, do bear in mind that you should work through some of the formulae that I had. And in particular, you'll be able to download this and work through it, or use some of the sources on the web, such as the D-Brain primer and other stories. Okay, so yes. Remember I did the story for SON just now with the oriented fold, and then I said there were N/2 D-Brains and their images. That's what the Wilson line told you. So N/2 is indeed 16, where N is 32. Does that make sense? Okay. Any other questions? Some people will say 32 D-Brains because they count in the covering space. Okay. So let's return to supersymmetric strings. So we did all of that stuff, and there are all sorts of sort of messy bases and things like that. But at the end of the day, when the dust settles, there's a very nice simple table that we can list everything. And so I'm going to list all of the known superstring theories or supersymmetric string theories for you. So there's the name of it. Is it open or is it closed? Here's a random comment. And looking at the massless sector, which is what we've been focusing on, what's its content? So there's type 2a and type 2b. They're closed superstrings. They have a lot of supersymmetry. They have n equals 2 in 10 dimensions. There's the type 1 string theory with SO32 gauge group. It's an open string theory. It has n equals 1 supersymmetry in 10 dimensions. And just for completeness, I've also listed the two heterotic strings, which we haven't talked about much in this story. But I'll say some more about it in the imaginary extra lecture where I talk about strings of strong coupling. So the massless fields look like this. There's that basic gravity multiplet, the B field, the graviton, and the dilaton. And then there are a bunch of red fields. they weren't red on the board, but they're red here, which I color-coded for a reason I'll explain in a minute. A bunch of fields which came from the Ramon sector. Then there was a gauge field in the type 1 string theory, and there was also a red field there as well. The heterotic strings don't have red fields. What does red mean? The fields in black are from the Novoschwartz sector. The fields in red are the Ramon sector, which we spent a fair amount of time worrying about. Okay, so let's move on from that. It's just a reminder of various things that we were talking about in detail last time. So I wanted to notice a few things, and I was going to spend a little bit of time telling you about the heterotic string, but time does not permit, so I'll just maybe if we do get to it, I'll say it then and move on. So, and this is just a reminder of one of the actions that we had. I will use this later on because I want to remind you of the fact that we got a very specific normalization for Newton's constant, a very specific normalization for how all of these fields couple, for example, in the type 2a, but we've also done it for type 2b and type 1 now. Okay, so, and I guess, I do want to say that. Notice that the factor of the dilaton that tells us about string perturbation theory appears only in front of the Novoschwartz sector and not in front of the Ramond sector. And yes, that is a clue, as I may have alluded to last time. That seems to be telling us that somehow the strings don't act as sources of the Ramond sector at any order in string perturbation theory. They just show up immediately on the sphere for the Novoschwartz stuff. And there's no power of e to the phi at all in front of the Novoschwartz stuff, the Ramond stuff, suggesting that perhaps we have to look elsewhere for sources of the Ramond sector. Okay, so in some sense, the strings describe the quanta of the Ramond fields, but cannot describe, but cannot source them. So one of our next goal is to look for sources. So I want to observe a couple of things. Well, actually more than a couple. Notice that they all have a metric, a two-index antisymmetric tensor, and a dilaton. Okay, that's kind of interesting. And even the type 1 string, in a sort of perverse way, contains something that is kind of like that thing I was calling the gravity multiplet. except that it, remember the beam you knew that we had, which started out being in the type 2b sector, got projected out, but then cmu knew stayed in, and I'm going to pretend that these two like to talk to each other in something like a gravity multiplet, and that would be fanciful if I only knew about string perturbation theory, but it's actually telling me something about non-perturbative physics, which we probably won't get to, but that's just a clue for you to go explore in that direction. Why is there always that multiplet? Well, just to remind you, g mu nu is a graviton, and phi sets the local value of the string coupling. So what does B do? What does the antisymmetric tensor field do? Well, what that does is it's the thing that the string really is the source of the antisymmetric object. And what it does, it essentially gives dynamical weight to the string's ability to wind. What it actually does is something analogous to what you do in particle physics. You have some particle, it's charged under some gauge field, and you write a world volume action, you write a world line action to couple it in, something like this. And the world line is what I call sigma. Well, you can write something analogous for the string. There's a string. There's its world sheet. So I can naturally integrate a B field on that world volume, a world sheet. And it would look like this. So it's nice always when you have an object to integrate some antisymmetric, or it's natural to integrate some antisymmetric object in this compact notation, which I've expanded out for you. So, so you can measure the B charge carried by the string. How would you do that? You do it analogously to what you do for a particle. What you really do, if you recall, is you define there's A is the thing that's being sourced. You define the two-form field strength in four dimensions. You can then describe a two-form dual, and it's that two-form dual that you integrate over the S2 that surrounds the particle in question in order to measure its charge. Well, you can do exactly the same thing for a string. You have a string in D dimensions. You can surround it by a D minus 3 sphere. And so what do you do? Well, it's now its natural object is B2, so that tells me to form the field strength H3. I form its Hodge dual HD minus 3, and that's the thing I should integrate in order to compute the charge. Why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because this should be familiar. Then this is the next thing you should think of naturally in your geometric reasoning. And then it immediately tells you what you need to look for when we go back to the strings. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write out the type 2a, b, and 1 theories with those red fields. I'm going to write all of the things I can write, either the low rank ones or construct the higher rank ones by Hodge duality. So I form the field strength, and then write that as D of something, and thus write out all of the high rank fields I can. So I've been somewhat enthusiastic here and put all the indices in rather than just telling you what the rank is. And so, well, it kind of looks like there might be fundamental charge carriers for these objects too. And so this is where I get to, so how would we construct those? Well, we'd measure their charges in a way analogous to what I talked about. We'd form the field strength G, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So at the end of the day, we should be able to find an object that has spatial extent p directions, whose world volume is p plus one dimensional, and then I would just couple it with a term in the world volume action. That would look like integrate over the world volume, which is now p plus one dimensional. I would integrate c p plus one. Okay, and that would couple in to the physics of the brain with something that I will call the charge mu p. It's just a number which we would need to compute. So that is the action I would use for those sources. Well, as you might imagine, and there's the 8 minus p sphere I would use. So, of course, you might imagine then, so there are our brains that we've discovered. And these, in fact, do turn out to be the sources of that sector. So at this point, if I had another lecture, what I would do is I would spend a fair amount of time showing you precisely how to compute that number, that charge, mu subscript p. But I don't have time, so what I'm just going to do is draw you a picture and urge you to carry out the calculation in your own time. And the point is, the logic works simply as follows. What I have is I have a brain, and by definition, an open string can end on it. That's where we started. Okay, but then I ought to be able to consider the following one loop process, for example. The open string goes around in a loop. It goes around a loop, and I should draw that for my Feynman diagram. But then I can, at this point, I would not be able to stop someone who just walked into the room at that moment from saying, oh, that's a brain emitting a closed string. Right? So they chose a different time slicing of this diagram, and rather than think of it as a string going around that way, an open string going around that way, they considered it as a closed string being emitted by the D-brain. So what you can actually do is set up a calculation that investigates this picture, because remember that our closed strings contain the Ramond-Ramond sector fields and the Novoschwarz-Novoschwarz sector fields that we've looked at. And so this is telling us that the brain is, in fact, acting as a source of those fields. And in fact, you should be able to measure the charges, the strength to which it couples. So for the gravitational sector, for G, the strength is, of course, what we would call its mass, or its mass per unit length, its tension. So we should be able to compute the tension of these objects, and indeed their charges of the Ramond-Ramond sector, if any. And we could just set up the calculation and see if we get zero, then that's fine. So we can just set it up and compute and see if we can get some non-zero numbers. And so at the end of the day, what we find is that the Novoschwarz-Novoschwarz sector, these guys do source G and phi, but not B, because the string does that. And in the Ramond-Ramond sector, then a P brain, a DP brain, sources the P plus one rank form as advertised. Is everyone happy with the logic of that? Because even if we're not doing the calculation here, the where this comes from is sort of fundamental to a lot. Any questions? Okay. So at this point, I have no idea what's on the next slide either. So, yes. Good. So immediately we conclude something important, which is that in these supersymmetric string theories, we have odd brains in the type 2 and type 1 theories, and we have even brains in the type 2a theories, because we can just count the ranks of the forms. So what does that not mean? That does not mean that we cannot have even brains in type 2b and type 1 and odd brains in type 2a. It just means that these particular ones are sources of these particular fields. But you could have the wrong rank brains, the wrong dimension brains in the theories. They just wouldn't source these fields. And it'll turn out that they are not necessarily stable. So we'll talk about stability in a moment. Okay. So that completes our table, and yes, good. So there's a really important calculation. As soon as you realize this, well, what I just said about sourcing, etc., which is part of the classic paper of Porchinsky in 95, there's something else you should check. There's something very worrying that could go wrong. Remember, I wrote out the low-rank fields, and then by Hodge duality, I wrote out the high-rank fields as well. And then I've gone into my string theory, and in principle, I can compute absolutely what these charges are. But now I should be afraid of Professor Dirac, because what I've done by writing fields and their Hodge duals and constructing electric sources of all of those things, some of those things are magnetic sources. The magnetic cousins of, okay, let me start again. Electric sources of high rank fields can end up being magnetic sources of low rank fields, which already have electric sources. And so I need to check that that Dirac quantization is in fact still preserved. So just to remind you, how do you do that? In four dimensions, what you do is you surround, for example, a magnetic source with which let's call it a monopole to pretend we're doing physics here, and we can take an electron and circulate around it and look what happens to the electron's wave function in the quantum theory. And what we'll find is that the Dirac string that you introduce by not being able to write, this point. Remember I said I take C, I take a low rank form, Cp plus 1. I form its field strength, P plus 2. These are meant to denote ranks. And then I Hodge dualize with star to get G 8 minus P, taking 10 away. Okay, and then I'd like to write this as D of C 7 minus P. Okay, but I can only do that locally. Globally, I have that thing called the Dirac string, which I don't want to be physical for the usual reasons. It's just messy to go around carrying infinitely long solenoids on everything. And so what Dirac told us is that in the four-dimensional version of that with points, the wave function looks like this, where E is the charge and G is the magnetic charge. And at the end of the day, I can make the Dirac string absent by asking that EG over H bar is 2 pi n. So that gives me a fundamental relationship between the electric and magnetic charges on the theory. And in fact, okay, in the theory. So I'd better satisfy this relation in our 10-dimensional theory, where you have all of these electrons and monopoles of various dimensions floating around. And in fact, so the story goes through as follows. Here now I have instead for example, the magnetic source there as before. And I can circulate around, so there's that procedure I just discussed, and I can circulate around. The dp brain is the magnetic cousin of a d6 minus p brain, or vice versa. And so I should check that the dp brain wave function does not have this annoying feature. And in fact, the phase I pick up looks like this. So this I've done using precisely the normalization of the supergravity action that we've been using. So it actually picks up, because of the way we normalize things, a factor of 2 kappa 0 squared. You can see that that must be there because the kinetic term for G has a 1 over 2 kappa squared in front of it. So the flux that you measure will pick up that factor, and it's the flux that comes in here. So I have mu p, mu 6 minus p times 2 kappa naught squared. So for this Dirac string, or which is, of course, more generally a Dirac sheet, to be absent in the theory, we should have the following condition on our charges. So it turns out that you can, as I said, go and compute explicitly the charges, mu p, in the string theory with an absolute normalization using diagrams like that, as I said before. So there's two brains interacting via various exchanges. And it turns out that in the normalization that we've been using, the charge of a D brain, a DP brain, is this. Mu p is 2 pi to the minus p, and then precisely the factor of alpha prime you need to get the dimensions right. Okay? So that's its Ramondamon charge, and you can compute its tension. And its tension is, well, the Ramondamon charge multiplied by G string inverse. And that would be significant later on. OK, so if you actually stick these numbers in, so this is an exercise for you to do, I don't know when, stick this formula for mu p, so compute mu p, compute mu 6 minus p, throw those in to the formula, and recall that 2 kappa 0 squared is given by 2 pi to the 7 alpha prime to the 4, and you will find that precisely the case, the formula, the Dirac quantization formula, Dirac, Nepomniachtchi, Teitelbaum is the full higher dimensional version of it. Condition is satisfied, but not only is it satisfied, it's satisfied with the minimum value that it could have been. N is 1 in that formula. So what that means is that D-brains not only consistently carry the charges of the Ramondremont sector, but they carry it with the smallest possible value. In some sense, they are the fundamental sources of Ramondremont charge in the theory, in this way of doing string theory. So in perturbative string theory, this way we've arrived at studying this sector of the theory, that is what D-brains are. They are the fundamental sources. Well, you might challenge that last statement that they are the fundamental sources and that they're the smallest objects. Clearly, quantum consistency says that if I had something smaller, I'd be in trouble. But you might want to ask, how do I know from some other perspective that that is the case? And the other very important fact about D-brains comes into play here, and that is these D-brains we've been discussing are BPS states. What does that mean? You actually may know that because you've just done the supersymmetry course. Did you get to BPS states in the supersymmetry course? No? No? Okay. You didn't do extended supersymmetry? No? Okay. Well, in view of the time, I'm not going to be able to tell you either. okay. So the short version of the story is that the supersymmetry algebra, for example, one way of arriving at this, the supersymmetry algebra tells you that, in fact, there is a lower limit on the mass. So the supersymmetry algebra ends up knowing about various things I will simply call charges. They actually are central charges in the full parlance. And the Ramondremont sector charges that we've been studying are the appropriate charges in this supersymmetric theory. So I have objects who carry the charge of the charge of the sector in question, which I'm just going to call Q. And these objects, being dynamical objects in the theory, have possibly some mass, which we can compute. And there is a lower limit on, did I say that right way around? No, I said it wrong way around. I mean this. there is a limit with possibility of equality on the mass of this object given its charges. And so in the context we're discussing here, the D-brains, and this is for all objects in the theory carrying those charges. And so in this context here, what we have is mass per unit volume. So we have charge, tension. So we have what the tension of an object has to be given the charges, which I would call mu p to conform with my previous notation. And there's a normalization in the way we've normalized our supersymmetry algebra, which we haven't written, which has the 1 over g, which has the 1 over g in it. So this happens in several kinds of theories, including field theories. And schematically, this is what happens also in the string theories, where mu talks about the charges of the Ramondremont sector. If you haven't done this before, but you may have done some general relativity, there are analogous things in that context as well when you start studying things like charged black holes. There are natural bounds which arise, which also can be embedded if you make those supergravity theories. Those can be embedded in that same story. So what you find is that if you, the theory forbids you from having masses that are lower than the charges. They just do not exist. The theory is inconsistent with them present. And what we found in fact, is that dbrains, so let me call this tau p with a tilde on it to say some random tension of a p-dimensional object. What we found is that dbrains have precisely what people just say is their mass equal to their charge. They are BPS, so they saturate the Bogomolny-Prasad-Sommerfeld bound, or is it Sommerfeld? Sommerfeld. Bound of the, in the theory. And so the point is, oh, I could have saved myself some trouble. And just, the point is that they are the lightest states because they can't decay into anything smaller. It actually, there's a lot more to be said about that, which I won't have time to say. But they also, because they do not interact with each other, it turns out, a lot of things that could have corrected various features of their mass spectrum do not occur. And so people will possibly use in later courses the fact that the BPS spectrum is something that you can compute independently of the coupling. So you can compute in weak coupling and deduce things about strong coupling because you can trust that formula for the BPS sector. So what I want to say here, this attraction balances repulsion you should at least intuitively be happy with. How does it work? Well, remember that the dbrains are sources of gravity, which always attracts. And then they're like charged under some generalized U1, so they repel. Okay? And if you tune the values of the charges in just the right way, the mass and the charge, and in the normal units we're using, that's to set the mass equal to the charge, the attraction and the repulsion will precisely balance each other. And so that is this statement here, that they do not interact with each other. So if you have a bunch of brains, it turns out if you have a bunch of brains all of the same type lined up in the same way, they won't interact with each other, and so you'll have the freedom to just move them around because there's no potential for their separation. And in fact, that makes sense then of what we were doing earlier in terms of looking at families of scalar fields corresponding to the transverse position of those brains. So in the world volume theory, those scalar fields will have no potential. And so that would be the gauge theory interpretation of that fact. OK, so I'm now at the point that I wanted to tell you, give you some glimpses of some other aspects of dbrains. So this is the main message I wanted to get out today, T to RT dbrains, properties of supersymmetric strings, etc. We did it in this somewhat accelerated fashion. And then you see, I had everything beautifully timed, so then I would then have 20 minutes left over. But we lost that 20 minutes due to the technical stuff and me going to get something. So I'm not sure how much of your time to borrow to tell you a little bit. Basically, there's some loose ends which I deliberately left hanging at places in the lecture that I wanted to now tie up. So given that none of the organizers are here, we'll just maybe borrow a few minutes so that you don't go away feeling cheated with your consent. Is that okay? Yeah? Okay. So let's just steal a few minutes to do that. So there's several pieces of technology that I could tell you about at this point. There are various ways we could go now we understand all these properties of dbrains. People will take you in various directions, such as focusing on the world volume dynamics of the brains. Others will tell you about the fact that because these brains are sources of gravity, if you start sticking lots of them in the same place, you might start having a back reaction on space-time. So you then need to start describing these brains in different ways in terms of the metrics, the space-time fields, the space-time background fields that they produce. So people start writing curved space-time metrics representing brains. And then someone else will come along and tell you, well, actually, this is kind of the same thing. And one description is, in fact, very much like the other in various regimes, and then you'll discover the ADS-CFT correspondence and things like that. So those are the things to look forward to, and I'm not going to tell you about any of that in view of the time. But what I wanted to do was to go back and I wanted to pick up that anomaly story that we played with, because there are actually some clues about the properties of brains to be found in that story. So what I want to do is make a few remarks about the D-brain world volume action. Or should I tell you about string duality instead? Okay, I'm not going to have time for both. Which one? Okay. Okay, world volume actions. Okay. sorry, there's also a string duality story, which is kind of fun as well. Oh, thanks. Okay, world volume actions. So what I didn't spend perhaps as much time as I would have liked is saying a little bit more about the world volume actions of the D-brain. So we've already begun to see pieces of it. We've seen, for example, that there is some Yang-Mills sector on the world volume. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start trying to build some comments about the D-brain world volume. So let's come up with some D-brain world volume coordinates, which I'm going to, just to be perverse, I'm going to give a different letter. So I'm going to call it whatever that is. So what we found is that there's a trace F squared on the world volume as a result of the work that we've been doing. There's something like a Yang-Mills coupling here, so I should probably put in something like minus a quarter, and then there's some thing which is going to be the Yang-Mills coupling. And actually, what we've learned is that this took place at the level of the disk, the tree level, and open string perturbation theory, so there's actually an e to the minus phi there as well. Okay, so what I want to do is point out how this relates to something else that people will write down. And unfortunately, I won't be able to derive it. So first of all, before I go any further, what we've discovered is that for the supersymmetric brains, we now know that we should also have the following coupling, where we integrate over the world volume of the brain as well. And we've computed that quantity, mu p, there it is, upstairs. So actually what this should be is something that starts out as the action for some extended object, which should start out being rather like the first thing we wrote down, if you recall, which was the Nambu-Goto action. So I might have asked for something like this, something that I would write as the tension of the object, dp plus 1 coordinate, and then I would have expected to have something which I'll write schematically as this det gab to the half, where GAB is the pullback. Just in the same way in the first page of your notes you saw we did for the string, where I have the pullback of the world volume of the brain. The pullback of the metric to the world volume of the brain. And it's okay to get restless because I'm in running an overtime, onto overtime, so sure, go ahead. Knock yourself out. So there we go. What is the relationship? How do I connect this story to this story is one of the things I'd like to tell you about and just show you that both of these pieces are embedded in a larger action, which I'm going to write down and then motivate very briefly, which looks like this. The full action that people will write, The full action that people will write down is something called the Dirac-Born-Infeld action, and it looks like this. And so it's a bit more of a complicated looking object, and in various cases it becomes either this or this, depending upon what we're studying. So notice first of all, so I have GAB and BAB. So again, you can just get those from this. Then I have a 2 pi alpha primed FAB, and FAB is intrinsically defined. It's the world volume gauge field strength. It's intrinsically defined, so there's no pulling back required. And the point is that the if you recall, we ended up with the Yang-Mills action at leading order in alpha primed. Okay, so the question is. What you need to do is simply ask, in the case where alpha primed is small, if I expanded this thing, switching off the dilaton and B, which we can do, we can work in a background where those are switched off, so if I set this to say a constant, let's just say phi zero, and so let me now call this phi zero, and I set B equals zero, and then I expand this, and I use a formula for how to expand the determinant of that matrix, you should know that this is what you'll get. So this is what you'll get. I'll now call this 1 over G string, the background value of the string coupling, and so you find that, in fact, G squared Yang-Mills is indeed 1 over G string, and then, depending on what dimension you're in, a bunch of numbers here. And those numbers simply follow from whatever the D-brain tension is. So that's one observation I wanted to make. The second observation, then, is that in the absence of these other pieces, you can see that it's also then just something like a Nambu-Goto action. Telling you that the brain likes to reduce the area which it subtends as embedded in the space-time. So something else you should know, and then I will stop, is that this is only part of the story. So what I should write down then is this plus mu p integrate c p plus 1. And so I'll invite you to look this up yourself in view of the time, but I'll just point out that there's an important family of additional contributions to this coupling that I'm pretty sure people are going to use. So what they're going to do is they're going to, for example, wrap brains. For example, they'll use some of the technology that Paul was using. They'll take brains and they'll wrap them on various, say, submanifolds, some cycles in the Calabi-Yau manifold, and there'll be various discussions about the fact that there will be various terms induced, starting out, for example, with lower rank forms with various coefficients, which will be induced in this procedure. In the supersymmetric case, for example, you'd have something like that. And so what I'll do is I'll add a little bit of notes in the version of this that I have on my computer. I'll add some notes about how these terms come about very naturally. And in fact, if you go back to the Green-Schwartz action that we added to the story in order to make the type 1 string theory consistent, what you find is that there's already an interpretation of the Green-Schwartz action in terms of the presence of some D-brains world volumes with particular inducings of certain couplings in the world volume action. And in fact, that is the way in which you begin to see that D-brains know actually a lot of topology, because the origin of several of those terms is entirely topological. And so various people will tell you topological properties of brains, the inducing of various world sheet coupling, world volume couplings. So this, for example, says that I have a brain which is p-dimensional, but it's also, because of the inducing of these extra terms, looks like it has the charges of some lower ranked brains as well, lower dimensional brains. So I'll write a little bit about that, but you really should know about that in preparation for some of the things that are going to happen next week. So I'll stop here and apologize for not being able to tell you more, but I hope you at least got something out of that which I did tell you. Thanks.